I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Monday, February 16th, 2026, and the time is 3:30 p.m. Please turn off your cell phones. Committee members present today, Senator Rauscher, Senator Dunbar, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Klayman, and myself, Senator Giesel. I am expecting Senator Myers and Vice Chair Wilikowski. Ah, here comes Senator Myers now. I'm expecting Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski shortly. We have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Heather and to Susan, who are helping us out with the record of the meeting and the audio. We have two bills on the agenda today. The first one is Senate Bill 180, LNG import facilities. The second one is Senate Bill 227, tax compact, sales tax, oil gas tax. We're going to start out with Senate Bill 180, LNG import facilities. And just for the record, welcome Senator Wilikowski. So today we're having public testimony on Senate Bill 180. So at this time I'll open public testimony. I see no one on the audio, calling in to testify. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 180? All right, seeing no one, I'm going to close public testimony. We will set this bill aside for a future resource committee meeting. We'll move on next to Senate Bill 227. The name of this bill is Tax Compact, Sales Tax, Oil Gas Tax. This is offered by the Governor's Office. Legislative Drafting Division takes bills that the governor, the administration offers to us, and reconfigures them into legislative format. In other words, the Department of Law writes the bills, but they don't comply with legislative drafting requirements. And so the bill has been redrafted, contains all the contents, but it's just put into a format that the legislature requires for bills. And so we do have that version in front of us, or is before us for adoption today, and it is Senate Bill 227 version N, N as in November. So, Vice Chair Wilikowski, I look to you for a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we adopt CS for Senate Bill number 227/N as our working document.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. I will invite my staff, Paige Brown, to come forward and explain the changes in version N as in November.
For the record, Paige Brown, staff to Senator Giesel. Thank you, Madam Chair. The differences between version A and N are technical and conforming changes from legislative legal to comply with their drafting manual. There are no substantive changes from version A to version N. And we have Emily Nauman on the line with any questions, if there are any questions.
Very good. Committee members, any questions, discussion? All right. Seeing none, then I will remove my objection, which puts version N before us. Senator Rauscher?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just thinking the memorandum. Can we talk about the memorandum?
We can certainly
Before we bring it up?
We can call on Ms. Nauman to discuss it with you if you have questions particularly.
Yeah. I was just wondering about the constitutional issues.
We can certainly ask her. Ms. Nauman, can you hear us? Ms. Nauman, you might be muted still.
Yes, you are right. Emily Nauman, Legislative Legal Services.
Very good. Thank you for joining us. Senator Rauscher had a question for you.
Yeah, thank you very much, through the chair. I was just wondering if we could just go over the memorandum real quick on some of the issues you wrote about.
Sure. Again, for the record, this is Emily Nauman, Director of Legislative Legal Services, through the chair. The memo flags, and I presume you're just interested in the two constitutional issues discussed in the memo, which appear on page one through three. The first issue that the memo flags is the single subject rule under Article 2, Section 13 of the Alaska Constitution. Every bill may be confined to one subject. There is one section of this bill, Section 31, that establishes the infrastructure maintenance surcharge on oil. And it also creates a pipeline corridor maintenance fund that directs the proceeds of the surcharge be deposited into the fund, and then says the legislature may appropriate the balance of that fund for maintenance and operations of costs incurred by the state along the pipeline corridor. I flagged that particular section, the creation of the fund and the direction of that fund to a specific purpose, as a potential single subject violation. And one of the reasons, or the primary reason that I did, is because in Croft versus Parnell, the Alaska Supreme Court considered a ballot initiative that proposed a new production tax and included a very similar soft dedication of that tax to clean elections. That was the fact pattern in Croft versus Parnell. And the court, threw out that initiative because it said it didn't comply with the single subject rule because it combined two topics, oil production taxes, with the unrelated topic of publicly funded elections. I had a concern that SB 227 in Section 31 had a similar scheme as that in Croft, where it had a soft dedication of funds for a particular purpose, in this case pipeline maintenance, that appeared to me unrelated to the broad subject of the remainder of the bill, which was taxes. So that's the single subject issue. The second constitutional issue that I flagged was the conditional effect section. Section 35 of SB 227 makes the bill contingent on enactment of several other bills into law, HB 275, which is the appropriation limit, HB 274, which is sunset reviews of state agencies, and HJR 30, which is a permanent fund restructure. And I want to say out of the gate that I don't believe that this would be a successful constitutional challenge, but it is a potential one. We have no precedent in Alaska about how the court might look at these conditional effect sections. In other words, bills that aren't combined into one, but bills that are contingent on other bills passing. Again, we have no precedent in this state, so we don't know how a court would treat them. In other states, we do know that state Supreme Courts have found no constitutional impediment to conditioning bills on one another if the act address a broad comprehensive legislative program. And because this bill, SB 227, appears to be contingent on at least what the governor is describing as, in my interpretation, a broad legislative program, comprehensive program, I think that so long as the Alaska Supreme Court followed the precedent set by other states, this bill is not likely to violate the single subject requirement because of its conditional effect. That doesn't negate the single subject analysis related to the pipeline fund, but as a separate issue, I don't think the conditional effects should cause too much consternation. Again, we don't know what a court will do, but that's my current assessment.
Quick follow-up.
Further questions, Senator Rusher.
Thank you. So I just want to understand what passage and court ruling it non-single subject. Are they the same? So in other words, non-passage and passage. So if it passes, but yet the court rules that there's a problem, so does that mean the original one is not reliant on this one anymore because the judge has ruled it out in illegal or whatever? So I'm just trying to understand what happens when you use the word passage. It passed the House, it passed the Senate, it got voted through, but yet the court does not allow it. Are they conflicting with each other and now 227 doesn't work? I guess that's how the question goes.
Ms. Nauman?
Yes, and I understand your question possibly to have two different but related questions within it. So the first thing I want to answer is that it's my belief, and again, we don't have any court guidance on this, that likely something similar to the single subject test would apply to these conditional bills that are linked together. We can look at Section 35, and that section makes conditional effect of this bill, SB 227, conditioned on this list of bills being enacted into law is the language that that section uses. So as I understand it, our revisor of statutes would not give effect to this bill, SB 227, unless she can determine that HB 275 or a similar bill has been enacted, SB 274 or a similar bill has been enacted, and HJR 30 or similar resolution is enacted. Now, HJR 30, I want to say, requires a vote of the citizens because it's a constitutional amendment. Yes.
So one last follow-up.
Senator Rauscher.
Thank you. So I just want to know, okay, so now if it goes to court, is it possible that we could have a sales tax initiated? Like, say that passes also. Is it possible that we could have a sales tax initiated before the court actually makes their decision and ruling?
Ms. Naumann?
Through the chair to Senator Rauscher, I suppose that's hypothetically possible. It would probably depend on what tactics the litigants used. For instance, it would be possible for one litigant in that type of litigation to ask for the sales tax to be put on hold until the issue was resolved by a court.
All right, well, thank you very much.
All right. Further questions for Ms. Naumann. Senator Klayman.
Ms. Naumann, going back from before this in history with the legislature, has there been a past time when a governor introduced a legislative package like this where they took two other bills and a constitutional amendment and the effectiveness of bill number one was contingent on the other two passing and the constitutional amendment passing? Is this a new event in Alaska history?
Again, for the record, this is Emily Naumann, Legislative Legal Services, through the chair to Senator Klayman. I can only speak anecdotally that this language was not new to me. I believe that I have seen it many times, especially in the last few years. I don't, off the top of my head, recall any language that I've seen this broad recently. In other words, I've seen like narrow conditional effects, you know, something where the department has to meet a certain threshold and they notify the revisor of statutes and then certain bill sections spring into effect. I can't remember a time recently where an entire bill was given a conditional effect based on enactment of three other bills. I would say I've seen that drafted. I've seen the legislature consider bills like that, but I haven't, to my mind right now that I can remember, think of one that has passed or been enacted.
Follow-up,
Senator Klayman.
I'll narrow the question a little bit. Are you familiar with any occasion, regardless of whether it was introduced by a legislator or by the governor, of any time in which the set of Bill A taking effect is contingent on Bill B taking effect? Have you ever seen that occur, at least in your knowledge of Alaska history?
Through the chair to Senator Klayman, unfortunately, my history is fast and fleeting in my mind. And like I said, I think I've been here about 15 years, and I can't think of one off the top of my head, but that is not near to say there hasn't been one. I'm happy to research it and see if I can find one that exists and get back to you.
Madam Chair, I would actually appreciate if
yes.
if they could answer that question, because I am curious if it's never happened before. That's
her get us the information. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Naumann, just thinking back to last year, we had HB 57 with two sections that were dependent on the enactment of SB 113. We're talking about two sections of a bill rather than an entire bill, but is that, legally speaking, is that comparable in your mind?
Through the chair to Senator Meyer, yes, that bill was similar and that did spring into my mind, but it's not, you know, two or three or four entire pieces of legislation. Your description is accurate.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think the legislature in 2017 passed a bill that was a four-pillar bill contingent on oil taxes, contingent on a couple other things that included something of an income tax in it. I think the House did that. And it had contingency language in it. Going back to a question I had on Section 31 dealing with the single subject rule. So you're saying if that pipeline corridor maintenance fund were just removed, or the infrastructure maintenance surcharge on oil were to go to the general fund, it might not break a single subject?
Through the chair to Senator Kawasaki, that's correct. I think if you took out 325, which is creating the fund and then giving the legislature the authority to designate it for a specific purpose, if you took out those six lines of the bill, the issue would be relieved. You could probably leave, you know, parts of them, but I think if you took out that entire section, the issue would be moved. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Nauman, for being available. Are there further objections to the adoption of version N? Seeing none, version N is now before us. I have asked the Department of Revenue to come and elaborate on that last section. We talked about several sections of the bill. We did not include the 15 cent per barrel fee surcharge. And so I did ask Revenue to come today, and with us is Mr. Dan Stickle, Chief Economist, Department of Revenue. I don't know if Brandon Spanos is here. Let me see. He is online. And Janelle Earls, she's the Acting Commissioner, Department of Revenue, is here with us. If you would come forward and briefly review this one section that we hadn't gotten to.
Thank you, Chair Giesel. For the record, Janelle Earls, Acting Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. And as you stated, we have Acting Tax Director Brandon Spanos on the line and Chief Economist Dan Stickle, who can speak to these fees.
Very good. Mr. Stickle?
All right. Madam Chair, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue, for the record. And I believe we pulled out three slides from our earlier presentation. So slide 32 talks about the new 15 cent per barrel fee. This would be a fee on all taxable oil production in the state. It would be paid along with the oil and gas production tax, so producers would remit that at the same time. It is modeled on the existing hazardous release surcharge that provides a designated funds for Department of Environmental Conservation. That's the so-called nickel per barrel surcharge on the production tax. And so the statute is very, very similar to that existing surcharge. No credits or deductions can offset the fee as part of the production tax payment, and the intent is to use the proceeds to provide a sustainable and permanent funding source for maintenance and infrastructure costs along the pipeline corridor. So these funds would not be available for the pipeline itself, that's separate, but for things like maintaining and improving roads and waysides, Dalton Highway in particular.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. My understanding, this raise is about, is it 16 million per year, 15, 16 million a year?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, looking at about $25 to $30 million per year.
And if I could follow up.
Yes, follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
And this is a permanent fee, permanent tax? It doesn't expire?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, correct. It would be a permanent fee.
Okay.
And follow up.
Does the Dalton... And this is this predominantly the Dalton Highway, or what do you consider to be the pipeline corridor?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, so that's my intent is that the Dalton Highway, or my understanding that the Dalton Highway would be a significant component of that. We do have Office of Management and Budget here if you'd like to get into any technical details on how the funds might be used in the intent.
Follow up?
Perhaps. Is the public what percentage of the time is the Dalton used by the public as opposed to by the industry?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I don't know.
Would somebody on the line know? Maybe somebody in the panel here knows. The committee.
I am looking. I'm not seeing anyone from OMB here online. Oh, someone present in the room. Sorry, you're not listed here, but if you would like to come forward and offer your thoughts on that question, that'd be great.
Hello. For the record, my name is Tim Hess. I'm a policy analyst for the Office of Management and Budget. Senator Wielichowski, through the chair, I don't know the answer to how many percentage of public use the Dalton Highway versus industry, but we could look into it and follow up with you if that's okay.
Follow up, Senator Wielichowski.
Do you know the answer to the first question, like what is considered to be the pipeline corridor? Is it generally considered to be the Dalton Highway? Is that where the intent of this provision is to go?
Senator Wielichowski, through the chair, that's my understanding. I would probably want to follow up with you to get a more direct and sure response.
Follow up, Senator Wielichowski.
Can anyone in the public just drive up the Dalton Highway? Or do you have to get permission?
Yes. Senator Wielichowski, through the chair, I don't know off the top of my head if anyone.
The Dalton Highway is open to the public. I don't remember the year that it was opened up, but it's been several.
Mm-hmm. 95.
And follow up. Okay.
Follow up, Senator Wielichowski.
We heard from the Department of Transportation that the Dalton, they would need to spend $450 million over the next 6 years to get the Dalton Highway up to where it needs to be. Is that your understanding? Did I hear that testimony correctly?
Senator Wielichowski, through the chair, I didn't hear that personally. I would follow. I can follow up with them and get back to the committee.
Follow up, Senator Wielichowski.
I'm just curious. How did you come up with 15 cents a barrel? Who came up with that number?
Senator Wielichowski, through the chair, we modeled 15 cents per barrel. That's what, when you take the fiscal plan in its entirety, that's what roughly balances out.
Follow up.
So what do you mean it roughly balances out? Explain that to me.
Let me correct myself. It balances out at 15 cents per barrel.
Follow up.
What balances out? So the budget, you plugged in 15 cents a barrel so you could balance the budget? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Senator Wielichowski, through the chair, that's correct. I might look to Chief Economist Stickle for more, if there's a more technical explanation on how we modeled different cents per barrel, but 15 cents per barrel is what got us to a balanced budget with the entirety of the fiscal plan.
Sure.
Mr. Stickle?
Dan Stickle again for the record to Senator Wielichowski through the chair. So I think this goes back to some of the comments that Commissioner and Acting Director made at the initial presentation. So what we did is we provided a range of modeling to the governor. And this was we provided the ability to model any number of different levers and rates on the different fees. And this was part of the comprehensive plan that he chose as his best option.
Follow up.
And if my memory serves me correct, I thought I heard the DOT commissioner say the Dalton Highway would need $450 million over 6 years, which comes out to $75 million a year. Mm-hmm. And if this is a pipeline corridor and it's used overwhelmingly by the industry for pipeline, why are we only charging an amount that would equate to $25 million a year instead of $75 million a year?
Sure, Senator Wielichowski, through the chair. And I mean, that's a good policy question to consider. Obviously, I didn't hear that testimony either. I haven't been following the Dalton Highway in excruciating detail, but from the sounds of it, this fee would provide a portion of the funds that would be required to maintain and upgrade the highway, and not the entirety of those funds.
follow-up. This will be the last one.
Okay. I mean, what was there a discussion of the policy reasons why the people of Alaska should subsidize $50 million per year for this corridor?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I was not personally part of those policy discussions.
Okay. Further questions? Senator Rauscher?
Madam Chair, thank you. Through the chair, I just wanted to offer something that on the Glen Highway, they put a car counter, one of those cables across the road, and they were able to tell whether it's a tractor trailer. They were able to tell whether it was a truck. They were able to tell whether it was a vehicle. So I guess what I'm wondering is if the DOT might have put a rope across the – we might want to contact the DOT, ask them if they have, and they could tell you the volume of traffic, whether it was actually cars or whether it was tractor trailers or whatever. And so it's just a thought if you wanted to answer the previous first question that was asked by Senator Wilikowski.
Sure, that's a great idea. We have revenue and OMB before us right now. Do you have a question for them?
No, I'm just offering that for later.
All right, any other questions for OMB or revenue? All right, you said you had three slides. I will let you go on. And Mr. Hess, thank you for stepping forward.
Sure, I believe so, Madam Chair. So the other slide that was pulled out was slide 36. So this is a the fiscal note. Part of the fiscal note, part of the of the presentation, and so the first section here is we provide the revenue impacts for the temporary increase to the minimum tax floor, and then the second section here is the where we provide the estimate for the infrastructure fee. The 15 cents per barrel would begin with fiscal year 2027, so that would be this coming July, and it would be applied to all taxable oil production statewide. We estimate that would bring in about $25 million per year, and actually that the amount of revenue would increase to about $30 million per year towards the end of the fiscal note based on our forecast for increasing production as new fields like Willow and Pikka come online. And then, as we've mentioned, it would be considered designated general fund revenue going into this newly created pipeline corridor maintenance fund.
Very good. Any further questions for Department of Revenue? All right, hearing none. Thank you very much for being here today and presenting that. Very good. So we have before us version N. Working with committee members, a committee substitute has been drafted that I would like to bring forward to the committee today and to the public. Senator Wilikowski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to adopt the Senate Resource CS for Senate Bill 227, Work Order 34-GS2496/I as our working document.
Thank you. So this would be version I as in India, and I'll object for purposes of discussion. I'm going to have my staff, Paige Brown, come forward to go through the explanation of changes in the latest committee substitute for Senate Bill 227.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Paige Brown, staff to Senator Giesel. So the changes from version N to version I start with eliminating the sales tax. We remove the conditional effect language that placed conditions upon other bills passing this session. We remove the effective dates that would have established varying effective dates for different tax programs. We also remove the effective dates that would have reverted specific tax regimes implemented by this bill to match existing state policy, effectively sunsetting newly enacted tax policy. The sections Section 2 was originally in the governor's bill. What we did add was Section 12, which combined add up to the current Senate Bill 113, which would modernize Alaska's corporate income tax law by adopting market-based sourcing for calculating the portion of a taxpayer's sales that are subject to Alaska's corporate income tax, and it adopts a single sales factor for calculating the taxable income of highly digitized businesses. So that would be the first provision we added. In Section 3, we added what is currently Senate Bill 92, which would require certain oil and gas S corporations and limited liability companies to pay corporate income tax, but it has been amended with brackets for taxable income levels and tax rates beginning at $1 million net income. Section 13, we have added an education head tax, bracketed based on yearly income, intended to be used to fund public education and deferred maintenance of education buildings and existing infrastructure. Section 14 maintains the 6% minimum tax in version N, and Section 15 added a provision ensuring that the 6% minimum production tax operates as a hard floor, adding that credits may not reduce tax liability below that minimum, and it removed the sunset clause from version N. Section 17 through 25, we added what is currently Senate Bill 112, which would reduce the sliding scale per barrel credit from a maximum of $8 to $5 per barrel, and ties their use to amount of qualified capital expenditures made in the same year. Sections 27 through 28 in the bill kept the 15 cent per barrel infrastructure maintenance surcharge on oil transported through TAPS and removed the sunset. And lastly, we added an effective date of January 1st, 2027 for the most of the provisions except for the S-Corp tax under Section 3, which goes into effect retroactively January 1st, 2026.
Thank you, Ms. Brown.
Is that all?
Yes, that's all. So, you know, one of the key pieces the governor emphasized with this bill was balancing everyone contributing to the fiscal stability of the state. And so that's what is endeavored with these changes. We certainly had heard from other committees, the public and emails, public outcry related to the sales tax. So endeavoring to make it a bit less onerous to the public, the sales tax was removed. The 15 cent a barrel related to the surcharge on the throughput through the pipeline is not a dedicated fund in this new version. There is legislative intent that it go toward maintenance of the Dalton Highway, which is continually needing upgrade because of its gravel. It's gravel, it crosses rivers that overflow every spring, et cetera. But it is not a dedicated fund, it's simply legislative intent. The same is true of the education head tax, which is legislative intent, that it go to education funding and infrastructure, schools that need more deferred maintenance attention. So with that, we will have presentation of the various pieces of the bill, and we have as invited testimony several folks. As long as you're there, Ms. Brown, would you proceed through the education head tax?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Once again, for the record, Paige Brown, staff to Senator Kathy Kiesel. So the education head tax.
Ms. Brown, could you go to that slide? Thank you.
There we go. The education head tax authorizes the Department of Revenue to collect an education tax on wages and self-employment earnings from a source in Alaska. The amount of that tax is based on an individual's income and established in statute. It would direct employers to withhold one half of the estimated tax due from each of an employee's third and fourth payrolls of the year and to maintain records of the withholdings. the employer is required to withhold the tax from the employee unless the employee can prove they have already paid the tax due for the calendar year. This provision also provides a mechanism for taxpayers to request a refund if an overpayment is made. And it does cover that self-employed individuals do need to report their own tax. And so with that, we created some brackets. If an individual is making $30,000 a year or less, the tax is $10. If they're making $30,000 to $90,000 a year, the tax would be $15. $90,000 to $150,000 a year would be $20. And then over $150,000 a year would be a $30 tax.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. That head tax can be found in Section 1 and Section 13 of the version I, as in India. We have not done fiscal modeling on it. The education head tax existed in Alaska prior to 1980 when it was repealed. It was at that time $10 on first paycheck. Adjusted for inflation, that would be about $110 first paycheck today. However, the brackets are, the amount is much lower, clearly available for amending to a higher rate if thought necessary, but a proposal to increase funding for education and the deferred maintenance on the buildings. Thank you, Ms. Brown. Then we have another section that deals with the highly digitized portion of the bill, and that is in, and I will invite Senator Wilikowski's staff, David Dunsmore, forward. The highly digitized tax can be found in Section 2 and starts in Section 12 of the bill. I think it's 12 and 13. Yes. No, 12, just 12, I believe. Welcome, Mr. Dunsmore.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, David Dunsmore, staff to Senator Wilikowski. Section 12 adds the provision from Senate Bill 113, which the legislature had passed last year that was not included in the governor's bill, which is the single sales factor for highly digitized businesses. Senate Bill 113 contained two reforms that would work in tandem to ensure that Alaska was properly apportioning revenue from business done in Alaska by online businesses to the state. In the estimates that the Department of Revenue gave for the fiscal note, they said that Senate Bill 113 would raise approximately $25 to $65 million annually. And according to their testimony to committees this year, about one-third of that would have come from the market-based sourcing, which was included in this bill as introduced, and two-thirds of that estimate would come from the single sales factor, which was not originally included in this bill. And the single sales factor for highly digitized businesses is necessary to fully capture revenue because it addresses the issue where, for many online businesses, where their physical presence is located is not really material to where their business is located. So using the traditional three-factor apportionment formula for businesses that were operate primarily online and maybe in different parts of the world and have zero payroll and property in Alaska, they'll be, even with the market-based sourcing, they would be diluting their Alaska tax liability by two-thirds. And so these two provisions in tandem work to assure that business done in Alaska is properly apportioned to Alaska.
Very good. Questions for Mr. Dunsmore? Can you give us examples of these highly digitized businesses for the public? I mean, what are we looking at here, and what will the impact be on Alaska's citizens?
Madam Chair, under this bill, or under this section, a highly digitized business would be And of course, since this is corporate income tax, we're only talking about C corporations, which would generally be corporations that have 100 or more shareholders. This, you know, it is highly unlikely that you would have a small business fall under that, because they would be getting very bad advice from their accountant if they incorporated as a C corporation. But these would be businesses that 50% or more of their Alaska sales are either done online or of computer technology. And then there was an exception for telecommunication businesses that arguably could have been, but it was determined when the Senate Finance Committee had reviewed previous versions of this legislation that the three-factor formula was appropriate for telecommunications, because those are businesses that do have intense physical footprints in the state. And so this would capture online retailers, or capture online streaming services, social media companies, online advertisers, and other businesses that do most of their business in Alaska online.
Thank you. And the impact on Alaska citizens?
Madam Chair, we've extensively researched to see if there's any example of consumer prices being raised as a result of corporate income tax apportionment. The answer is there does not appear to be any. Most businesses set their prices at the national or global level. So, for example, Netflix charges the same amount for a subscription in all 50 states, including South Dakota, which has no corporate income tax whatsoever, and Minnesota, which has the highest corporate income tax. And there's actually been some academic research on this. There was a working paper by the, I believe it was the National Bureau of Economic Research, that found that a single sales factor has a null impact, so zero impact on consumer prices.
Thank you. How many other states have a similar tax to this?
Madam Chair, other states have addressed this. One, for at least, I believe it's 38 states have a single sales factor for at least some industries. For many states, it is every industry. So most states have a single sales factor. Apply it to a broader category than this. This Alaska might, with this provision, be the only one that specifically has a carve out for highly digitized businesses defined this way. Some states have addressed the issue by focusing on intangible property, but that does not fully capture how all online businesses, for example, like an online retailer that sells a physical product, doesn't sell intangible property, but still has the same issues of their taxes being diluted by not having a footprint in Alaska.
Very good. Further questions? All right. Oh, Senator Wilkowski.
Just to get on the record, because I know there's some misconceptions about this provision. Is it expected that some of the revenue that is raised by this will come from other states' treasuries as opposed to corporations paying increased taxes?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, yes, that is correct. Many states use, as part of their apportionment rules, provisions that are called either throwback or throw out, that basically are designed that for any business where that state would have a reasonable nexus, but if another state is not taxing it, those states tax that. So it's we don't have an exact estimate on how much of this, of the $25 to $65 million would be raised, would be shifted, but we think a substantial, for the most part, this is income that is being taxed in another state, and that because of the throwback rules, the fact that Alaska is not apportioning it to us, other states are apportioning it to them.
This is a follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
Is there an expectation of how this, either of these provisions, will impact Alaska businesses? Will they result in increased costs or increased taxes to Alaska businesses?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, the Department of Revenue in their presentation earlier spoke about how businesses with an Alaska footprint could, that do extensive sales out of state, could potentially actually see a tax decrease as a result of these provisions. But generally speaking, a business that is based in Alaska would not see an increase. The businesses that would see an increase would be businesses that are based outside of state but do business into the state.
Follow up.
Is there any expectation that this will impact the shipment of Amazon products or Etsy products into the state of Alaska from small businesses or larger businesses?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we've looked into this extensively. We found no evidence of shipping policies being affected by corporate income tax apportionment. And we've, for example, we've seen, you know, Minnesota has the highest corporate income tax in the country. We've seen no evidence of online businesses refusing to ship to Minnesota as a result of their tax raise.
Follow-up.
And this would only apply to C corporations. Do you know what percentage of Etsy corporations or Amazon corporations or corporations just in the entire United States are actually C corporations versus other types of businesses that would not be affected by this?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I do not have that those specific numbers in front of me. My understanding is on Etsy, it is a very small percentage that would be potentially be C corporations. I believe the vast majority of Etsy sellers are single people selling products, either as a sole proprietorship or probably an LLC. C corporations are generally the largest corporations. You would only incorporate as a C corporation if you required having over 100 shareholders. And so these are not small businesses that will be affected.
Senator Klayman.
Just for clarity, Mr. Dunsmore, that we've got two types of taxes in this Senate Bill 113, the market-based sourcing and the single sales factor. And I know there's a portion of amongst the different states that have these. Does it apply both to the market-based sourcing and to the single sales factor, or only one of them, if that question makes sense?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, market-based sourcing would apply across the board for all industries that are apportioned under the multi-state tax compact. The single sales factor would only apply to highly digitized businesses.
Follow-up, Senator Klayman.
So that would mean it would apply to highly digitized businesses selling products in Alaska. So that would be essentially an Alaska-only tax for those businesses.
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, this would be the rules for how Alaska's existing corporate income tax are apportioned. As a result of our current sourcing rules that uses what's called cost of performance, there are likely many businesses that do significant business in Alaska but are able to claim to have zero Alaska sales and, as a result, pay zero taxes to Alaska. But this would not be a new tax. It would be new rules with regards to how income is apportioned for Alaska to determining corporate income tax liability.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dunsmore. Next, I'm going to call up Sonia Kawasaki. Sonia is going to speak to several issues related to the taxes in the bill. I'll ask Ms. Brown, could you move the slides, please? Ms. Kawasaki, if you could start with there's a couple pieces here. The moving the slider, so to speak, from $8 down to $5. The governor had not proposed this in his bill. A second component was moving the minimum tax from 4% to 6%, and we adopted that piece in the bill. But hardened the floor, so to speak. So if you could speak to those two pieces.
Sure, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Chair Giesel and members of the Senate Resources Committee. For the record, my name is Sonia Kawasaki, and I am Senate Majority Legal Counsel. The per barrel credit aspect of the committee substitute begins the substantive portion begins in section 22 on page 42. essentially, there is a bill and concepts through the years to reduce the per barrel credit sliding scale that started at $8 and would track to $0 depending on the price of barrel of taxable oil. And this CS would adopt a $5 maximum beginning at the highest range of the lowest range of taxable oil, which was the $80. This has been a concern through the years because since enactment of this per barrel credit in SB 21 in 2013, the state's risk has been mostly the state has mostly taken on all the risk of loss because the price of oil has always been below $80 per barrel. And we've lost a substantial amount of revenue due to that policy callback in SB 21. And the hardening of the tax floor, this I believe is section 15. Section 15 of the community substitute, which is page 32. In essence, there is a currently the minimum tax of 4% is a soft floor, which would mean that a producer can take a credit that that decreases it, the producer's tax liability below the 4%. With this bill, as the governor introduced the bill, it had a 6% minimum as opposed to 4%. The committee decided to keep that 6%, but then prevent any credits from being able to reduce the tax liability to below the 6%. In addition, Madam Chair, there was a sunset provision that would have reduce the minimum floor from the 6% as enacted back down to the 4%, and that was found in the effective date sections of the end of the bill, in the governor's version of the bill, and that sunset has been eliminated so that the 6% would continue on without sunset.
Thank you, Ms. Kawasaki. Can you elaborate on how one gets below a minimum tax?
Yes. Well, so there are various credits that may be taken in our tax structure that would allow beyond the 4% minimum to be applied, the tax credit to be applied to reduce the tax liability below that 4%. And it's allowed producers to sometimes get to zero.
Thank you. On page 32, section 15 is a new subsection, which states a credit under this chapter may not be applied to reduce the tax under E, that's this tax, below the amount calculated under the 6%. So that has been put in. Section 16 also does the same thing. A credit may not reduce the tax liability under this to below zero, which sometimes has happened as well with some of the tax credits that we offer. So thank you for that. And let's see, there was one last provision, Ms. Kawasaki, and that was the tax on S corporations.
Yes,
you can speak to that as well.
Sure. Again, for the record, Senator Kawasaki, Senate Majority Legal Counsel. The S-Corp tax of this bill is a variation of S-Corp tax proposals that we've seen through the body in the last few years. It basically applies to S-Corps and LLCs mainly, or pass-through entities that are not traditionally in federal law taxed at the entity level. They are only taxed through the members of the S-Corp or LLC. So this proposed tax would modernize our corporate income tax structure in recognition that S-Corps and LLCs may be similarly profitable to their corporate counterparts in the oil and gas industry. And this anomaly could continue into the future if we don't fix it now. So the new tax of the CS, unlike prior versions of this policy decision, includes bracketed according to taxable income and tax rates that is different than prior versions of this tax, including SB 92, which is currently still pending before the Senate.
So, Ms. Kawasaki, this relates to S corporations, which are owned by private individuals. They're not traded on the stock market. They have less than 100 shareholders. And they have been taxed in other states in what way?
Forgive me, Madam Chair. I actually didn't refresh my memory on those other taxes, but I can say that in researching last session that we do know that other oil and gas jurisdictions do tax their pass-through entities, S-Corps and LLCs, in various mechanisms to capture back tax revenue, despite the fact that that is not how the federal tax structure works for S-Corps and LLCs. And, Madam Chair, I could, if you'd like, I could do some research after the hearing and provide a more detailed response on that concern.
The basic answer is they're taxed by the personal income tax of the owners of the companies,
yes,
of the S corporations.
Yes.
So Alaska does not have a personal income tax. Consequently, S corporation owners do not pay any kind of corporate tax in Alaska, unlike states that do have personal income taxes. Correct?
Yeah, that's correct, Madam Chair.
Is this proposed S corporation tax structure equal to the C corporation tax structure?
Madam Chair, the current corporate tax is structured differently than this S corp and LLC tax. It, first of all, addresses all corporations in Alaska, and it has a differential in the brackets. It is a bracketed tax structure, but
are you referring to the C tax?
The
C corporation?
All right. Yes, sorry. The C corp tax.
It is in section. Hold on. Starts, I'm seeing it on section 24. There's also section 3.
It is, yes.
Yes,
Madam Chair, section 3 on page 21. Section 3 is.
Yeah, you're right. It's section 3, and that's on page 21. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please proceed.
Sure, Madam Chair. The current corporate income tax structure is bracketed differently, I would say, and then addresses very percentages that are different than the one that is being proposed in this committee substitute at the different levels of taxable income. For our purposes, probably for the most part, for corporations that are in the oil and gas tax business, if they have taxable income under current corporate income tax of $220,000 or more, their tax is $10,830 plus 9.4% of the taxable income, which is similar to the maximum tax bracket of the proposed tax for S corps and LLCs.
Thank you. Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I just want to make sure that the 6% hardened floor, that's permanent. It doesn't sound.
Ms. Kawasaki?
Through the chair, Senator Rauscher, that is correct on the 6%.
Okay, and one last question. Is there much that sunsets through the chair?
Ms. Kawasaki?
Through the chair, Senator Rauscher, I apologize. You mean sunsetting as opposed to versus the governor's proposal? Yeah.
There are no sunsets
in
this version. Version I, as in India.
I thought I cut to the chase. Thanks.
Very good. Very good.
Sun never sets in Northern Alaska.
Further questions?
I have some questions.
Yes. Senator Wilkowski.
I want to just address some potential legal issues on equal protection, on the corporate income tax. What would the court look at to analyze whether or not this met the equal protection standard? This corporate income tax change. S corp tax change.
Sure. Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. Thank you for the question. As far as tax law is concerned, a federal court's examination of disparate tax treatment is subject to the lowest level of equal protection scrutiny, which is the rational basis test. And the question is it rationally related to a legitimate state interest? And then similarly, in the state of Alaska, under Alaska Supreme Court analysis, a court will look through merely whether disparate tax treatment is substantially related to a legitimate government objective. Taxes, this is a quote from the Alaska Supreme Court, taxes are rarely found to be without a rational basis. That court and the U.S. Supreme Court have explained that a review of taxes under the rational basis test is especially lenient. The rational basis standard is particularly easy to meet in the area of taxation. The U.S. Supreme Court has further pronounced that legislatures have especially broad latitude in creating classifications and distinctions in tax statutes. And then, if I may, Madam Chair, there are basically two equal protection issues that have been raised as concerns in the past on this corporate income in a tax that would tax S-corps and LLCs. The first one being taxing oil and gas pass-through entities while not taxing pass-through entities of other commercial sectors, unlike our current corporate income tax, which taxes all the corporations. Then the second equal protection issue would be the proposal would have basically a automatic deduction at $1 million, which then steps into the brackets. And the brackets themselves generally, by my calculations, would result in a bit of a lower tax burden to the S-corps and LLCs in the oil and gas industry than their corporate counterparts. An analysis of equal protection for the first issue, which is taxing oil and gas pass-through entities while not taxing through entities of other commercial sectors. I would say I know from working with members in this body for several years now on this issue that the concern is that I do not believe that there would be a equal protection concern. Where we are a resource development state, we historically and foreseeably into the future, Alaska is highly still dependent on resource development. I think we can see that even in the governor's proposal where he eventually eliminates the other sources of tax revenue and goes solely with production tax. Oil and gas are non-renewable. They're finite resources. And in this case, the state owns the mineral rights to these resources, and that's different than other states. Mineral estates are normally held by private individuals and have varied ownerships. And so in those cases, those individuals can negotiate benefits differently than Alaskans can for their natural resources. And so there's something about, there's more gravity to the responsibility of the legislature toward Alaska's natural resources. And in fact, under Article 8, Section 2, the legislature is charged with the constitutional mandate to provide for the maximum benefit of our resources for the people of Alaska. So since the case law of the federal and state courts say that we only need a rational basis for the for an important state interest and a fair and substantial relation to the to the legitimate government objective, I think that trying to close a gap that exists in our highly profitable oil and gas companies doing the same work, making similar profits to their corporate counterparts, are not treated the same because one pays taxes and one does not. That is a legitimate interest. And then the amendment seeks to improve parity and more fairness in Alaska's taxing structures of its oil and gas development entities while ensuring the state gets benefits for the development of its natural resources.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
Yes.
I would just like to say for the record that I would concur with those remarks and would agree that the rationale for doing this is that it's a parity rationale, quite frankly. You have multiple companies on the North Slope that have paid this tax, this corporate income tax for decades. We've heard from the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Revenue, that one way that we achieve our constitutional mandate to get the maximum benefit for our resources is through the corporate income tax. And we are not doing that when we have one of the largest corporations on the North Slope paying zero corporate income taxes. This puts it in parity with the other corporations that have historically paid this for decades. And I think this has been warranted for many years. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski. I'll just add that we get an indirect expenses report from the Department of Revenue every few years. And this is listed, it goes back several years. I haven't been here decades, but I've been here more than 10 years, and I've seen it several times. Senator Myers, you had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Kawasaki, my understanding is that Glenfarne is organized as an LLC. Would they be, if Glenfarne did build the gas line in partnership with AGDC, would they be affected by this change in taxes?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, that is correct. The change in the tax structure toward LLCs would include directing the tax toward pipeline transportation companies.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Klayman.
This is a follow-up on what
Senator Myers was asking. I'm looking on page 22 of the bill. It's subsection E that's talking about, subsection E1 talks about qualified entity, and the subsection 2 of E talks about taxable income. And is it the taxable income section that limits this new tax to businesses that are in the production of oil and gas or the transportation of oil and gas?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, my response to that is the taxable income is a trigger identifying who would be subjected to the tax. Now, there is another section, if you look at the same page, subsection D2, that requires the department to include in the calculation of taxable income a qualified entity's income attributable to an entity that is qualified under the new tax in the unitary business structure. That is a corporate income tax concept that essentially a corporation is in a certain line of work has the ability to create other businesses that are in related lines of work, and so to avoid a avoidance of paying tax, that the IRS and our state tax division will aggregate the income of the entities that are all in the unitary business together. And so we adopted that same concept for this S corporation and LLC tax.
Follow up, Senator Klayman.
So if I'm an S corporation that sells groceries in throughout Alaska, does subsection E2 mean that as an S corporation that sells groceries, my income selling groceries doesn't, I'm not subject to this tax?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, that's correct. If you're a grocery seller, you are not in the production of oil or gas or in the transportation by pipeline business. So initially, that would be the trigger to bring income in from a entity who is an S-Corp and LLC would be in that line of work.
Follow up, Senator Klayman.
What about if I'm a oil services company that's running drill rigs on the North Slope under contract with some of the producers on the North Slope? Would that, if and assume that's an S-Corp entity, am I now, as the company that's running drill rigs under contract, am I subject to the S-Corporation tax under this definition?
Senator Klayman, through the chair, that situation would probably have to be looked at on a case-by-case basis, but it does not sound like that entity would be subject as a contractor with an S-Corp LLC because they are not a producer or making income from the transportation of oil or gas by pipeline in the state.
Thank you.
Senator Rauscher, I think you nodded at me. Does that mean you have a question?
That means I have a question.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I was wondering, through the chair, has any of this been modeled? In other words, have we modeled the oil and gas taxes through all types of price fluctuations and the other tax aspects to understand the revenue gain for the state?
There have been multiple modeling done, not specifically of this, and that's the point of putting this on the table because now it will be modeled. Okay. We'd have high level assessment of this, yes. And we know that at the $5 million level, that bracket, $9.4 million, if the net tax or the net profit is $5 million or more, it comes out pretty close to exactly what a C corporation is paying at that same tax level. We have not assessed the brackets below the $5 million net profit level. Further questions, Senator Rauscher?
So you said that it will be modeled.
It will be more extensively modeled. It has been very high level modeled at the $5 million net income level.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure. Further questions on any section that we've discussed? All right. Yes,
Ms. Kawasaki. Madam Chair, I didn't get to go through the second equal protection topic, which
Please.
Was the permitting the $1 million automatic deduction on these S-Corps and LLCs and establishing a differing tax bracket and rate structure from existing corporate income tax, which generally until the highest tax bracket and the highest income levels would result in lower taxes to S-Corps and LLCs. Now, the proposed amendment generally provides reduced tax liabilities for the pass-through entities than their corporate income tax counterparts. And I would just say that I do not, again, think that the equal protection claim on this basis would prevail because Essentially, historically, S-Corps and LLCs as business forms were established to allow small business owners more flexibility than the strict formalities of corporations. These structures allow members protection from certain liabilities and the double taxation that corporations and their shareholders experience. S-Corps and LLCs as legal structures were meant to allow smaller companies to manage to maintain flexibility and in management and internal oversight with less rigid legal requirements than corporations. Traditionally, S-Corps and LLCs were also less financially endowed than corporations, so a benefit to their structures was to aim to grow the entity's assets and financial security by not taxing the entity itself and only taxing the owners on their pass-through income. Corporations, on the other hand, can go public and create and sell new ownership shares by issuing more stock to raise needed capital for wealth-building endeavors. And today we know from experience with our own state that S-Corps and LLCs have the potential for massive wealth, not unlike their corporate counterparts. However, given the historic and, in some cases, enduring premise, I think we all can identify a couple of LLCs in Alaska that would apply to, that this amendment aims to balance establishing some parity and fairness to corporate counterparts while allowing less wealthy pass-through entities to keep more of their proceeds at the lower brackets, which would potentially grow their financial stability. So to the extent that the amendment permits reduced tax liability, this was a balance in policymaking decisions to allow potentially fledgling entities to realize a benefit in more financial security while recognizing that we must seek our maximum constitutional benefit for the people of our natural resources. And then I would just like to note that at the higher level of income bracket of the proposed tax, which is the $5 million, that the highest incomes of the more wealthy S-Corps and LLCs start to approximate more what is already existing corporate income tax.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski, question?
I just want to say for the record that I concur with those remarks as the basis for my supporting this change. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? There's a motion before the committee to adopt version I. I have objected for purposes of discussion. I am removing my objection. Is there further objection? Seeing none, version I is before the committee at this time. So I am going to open public testimony. We don't have a huge amount of time left for that, but I am going to start by asking in the room, is there anyone present who wishes to testify? This will be on version I, which we've just reviewed. All right, seeing no one, I will go to online. And I'm going to go based on when they first called in. The first person here is Rob Christensen, board member, Alaska Resource Alliance in Anchorage. Mr. Christensen, welcome to the committee. Because of the limited amount of time left in the meeting today, I'm going to limit testimony to 2 minutes. So if you would start by introducing yourself for the record and your affiliation, and then give us your testimony. Mr. Christensen, can you hear us? In that case, I'll move on to the second person. You're there? Is that you, Mr. Christensen?
Yeah, my apologies. I had you muted, too.
Okay. All right. Sorry. I know that happens. So welcome, if you would introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Okay. Madam Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Rob Christensen. I work for Sourdough Express Trucking Company. We've been in business for 127 years in Alaska, and I serve on the board of directors for the Alaska Support Industry Alliance. I am testifying today to express concerns about the impact of our economy from SB 227. Alaska's trucking industry is strong, resilient, and uniquely adapted to this state. Truckers move equipment, fuel, pipe, gravel, and supplies to keep Alaska's economy running, often in remote locations in harsh conditions and on tight timelines. The industry provides thousands of well-paying jobs, supports small and family-owned businesses across the state, and plays a critical role in keeping communities supplied. Oil and gas activity is one of the trucking industry's largest and most consistent sources of work. When energy projects move forward, trucking companies invest in equipment, hire drivers, expand maintenance operations, and create apprenticeship and training opportunities. When oil and gas is taxed more and investment declines, the trucking industry feels it almost immediately. Fewer drilling programs and construction projects mean fewer loads to haul, underused equipment, and difficult decisions about staffing. These are capital-intensive businesses. Trucks, trailers, maintenance facilities require long-term planning and predictable demand. Reduced investment creates uncertainty that small operators and rural haulers are especially ill-equipped to absorb. Over time, less oil and gas investment doesn't just reduce trucking work. It weakens the broader supply chain Alaska depends on. That means fewer jobs, less economic activity, and fewer opportunities for Alaskans who want to work and raise their families here. Alaska's trucking industry needs our competitive environment that allows industries that support, especially oil and gas, to invest, grow, and operate with confidence. So I respectfully urge the committee to consider how increased oil and gas taxes could ripple through supporting industries like trucking before moving forward. And thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Christensen. Next up is Kelly Droop, board member of Kenworth, Alaska. Welcome, Ms. Droop.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kelly Droop. I'm the regional manager for PAPE Kenworth, Alaska, and I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I've spent more than 37 years supporting Alaska's resource development industry, my own career, and I'm raising two daughters who hope to build their own futures here. Alaska competes globally for investment in a volatile energy market. Before companies commit billions to develop their resources, our resources, they compare Alaska to opportunities worldwide. Increasing taxes makes Alaska less competitive and pushes investment elsewhere. Stable, predictable policy is essential. Just like a homeowner wants certainty in their mortgage costs and not a bad adjustable rate mortgage, investors need certainty to move forward. Unpredictable taxation discourages projects, reduces jobs for Alaskans, and lowers long-term production. Declining production then threatens the long-term viability of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, which is essential to Alaska's economy. Once pipeline capacity is lost, it is extremely difficult to recover. The federal administration supports responsible development of Alaska's resources to strengthen national security, but higher taxes risk pushing investment away and undermining that goal. Sustainable state revenue depends on sustainable production. Recent headlines only focus on the short-term impacts from the ICER study. The narrative actually says any options implemented will have impacts on Alaska's economy and people, both in the short and long run. Those impacts include changes in the number of jobs, income, and the state's value-added activities. And with regard to an increase in oil taxes, it's stated, in reality, firms will change expectation of future tax changes. I urge the committee to maintain a stable, competitive fiscal environment that supports investment, jobs, and Alaska's long-term economic future. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Droop. Next in line is Roger Bach. He is a board member with the Alliance, calling in from Wasilla. Mr. Bach, welcome.
Hello, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Roger Bach, and I work for Colville. I'm a board member of Alaska's Board of Alliance Industry in Westwell. I'm here to speak about SB 227 and the real-world impacts that the increased taxes can have on investment and jobs in oil and gas industry. Oil and gas is not another sector of Alaska's economy. It's a foundation that supports thousands of direct jobs, tens of thousands of indirect jobs, and a significant share of state and local revenues. When policymakers talk about increasing taxes on this industry, it's important to understand how those decisions are viewed by investors making those long-term multi-billion-dollar commitments. Investments in Alaska already face unique challenges: high costs, remote logistics, extreme weather, long development timelines. Capital is mobile. Companies compare to Alaska, not just other U.S. states, but global opportunities with more stable, competitive fiscal terms. When taxes increase, uncertainty grows, capital does not disappear, it simply just goes elsewhere. When investment flows, the impacts are felt quickly. Fewer projects move forward, drilling programs are scaled back, contractors, service companies, and suppliers see less work that translate directly to fewer jobs, fewer apprenticeship opportunities, fewer young Alaskans choosing to build their futures here. Over time, reduces investment means lower production. And lower production ultimately leads to less, not more, revenue for the state while eroding economic and base that funds the public services. This is not about special treatment. It's about recognizing that stable, competitive policy is essential to maintaining investment, sustaining jobs, and keeping Alaska economically strong. Decisions made in this room send powerful signals to investors and workers alike. I urge the committee to carefully reconsider how increasing taxes would impact Alaska's competitiveness, workforce, and long-term revenue before moving forward. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Bach. Next, we'll move to Dan Dunaway. He's calling in from the Dillingham LIO. Mr. Dunaway, can you hear us?
Hello?
Hello. Mr. Dunaway?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we're struggling to unmute. I'm Dan Dunaway, a 37-year resident of Dillingham and a lifelong Alaskan. I just want to let you know I'm totally opposed to the state sales tax, especially as it's proposed. But in any form, we already have a 6% sales tax in Dillingham. To look at a total of 10% sales tax in the summer would be just brutal. In addition to having the tax burden, all of our goods and services are much more expensive than the rest of the state or much of the state. For example, we got $10 a gallon milk. Gas is $6.38. Ikiagig, a more remote community, is $9.47, and so on. And I think that the staffing that would be required to manage this would be excessive. As much as I'm reluctant for taxes, I think an income tax that would capture some of the revenue that gets exported out of this state from fishing, tourism, and oil is a better way to go. Those industries do pay some sales tax, but it's minuscule. I know some of them vigorously avoid taxes all prices, but at all opportunities. So I'm very much opposed to the sales tax. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Dunaway. The arguments you made are the reason that we deleted the sales tax from this bill. Thank you. And lastly, we have Teresa Obermeyer calling in from Anchorage. Ms. Obermeyer?
Good afternoon, Senator Giesel and Resources Committee. I wanted to first say, Senator Giesel, I appreciated your FY25 chart on the fact that we only get 13.8% from the oil industry. Ladies and gentlemen, can we stop giving away the store and taxing others? I can only say this, I cannot possibly understand a 56-page bill, but I saw the term multi-state, and I've been seeing this on several bills. I am for Alaska. Can we stop and make Alaska a place where we can live and raise a family? I represent 14 people, 8 registered voters, and 6 children. I'd like Alaska to be a place that has a good education and is a place that has a future. Instead, we just give away the store. I don't know what else to say. I just think you're all smart people, and we have to stop now, rise up, and say N-O to a few industries. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Obermeyer. I don't see anyone else online wishing to testify. Once more in the room, is there anyone wishing to testify? Seeing none, I will close public testimony on Senate Bill 227. Any further comments in the last couple minutes from committee members? All right. So the amendment deadline for this bill is set for noon on Wednesday, February 18th. We'll take up those amendments on February 18th at our meeting. This concludes our meeting for today. The next meeting is Wednesday, as I just said, at 3:30. We will be addressing Senate Bill 180, LNG import facilities, and Senate Bill 227, the bill we just reviewed. So at this time, the meeting will stand adjourned. Let the record reflect. The time is 4:59 p.m.